Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 97 for April 19th, 2011. My name is Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rebbe.
And I'm David O'Brien.
And we've got three stories for you this week. First, we're going to talk about a couple of Facebook suits that are back in the news. Second, we're going to talk about the FBI taking control of a botnet. And third, we're going to talk about a YouTube musician who pled to 60 days in jail as a result of some videos that he posted online. The first story is, as I mentioned, revisiting of a couple of Facebook suits. The first one, and it only deserves a brief mention, is that a little over a year ago now, the Winklevoss twins tried to get a settlement that they had previously made with Facebook thrown out. They were arguing that Facebook made some misrepresentations in these settlement negotiations, and as a result, the Winklevosses should either get more than they got in the settlement, or they should get an opportunity to renegotiate the settlement or reopen the suit. They lost the case in the district court, appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where they again lost on appeal. And barring the Supreme Court granting certiorari and deciding to hear the case, this case is essentially dead. And personally, I don't think it's a great candidate for cert. Any of you guys have anything to add on this other than what I've already said?
Nope. You did a good summary.
Yeah, this one looks pretty final.
Yeah, okay, so the next suit we're going to talk about is one that was in the news last summer, I want to say in either July or August. A man named Paul Ceglia, C-E-G-L-I-A, so maybe Celia if he doesn't pronounce the G, last summer filed a suit claiming that in 2003... Mark Zuckerberg had agreed to give Mr. Ceglia a 50% ownership project in the Facebook, which later, as we all saw in the social network, became just Facebook. At the time, Mr. Ceglia got, you know, basically a very brief stay of a freezing of Facebook's assets in New York court. That was then lifted, and now he has refiled the suit with a whole bunch of new evidence. And I think the most interesting part is that he has a big, high-powered firm behind him this time, the kind of firm that you would not expect to take the suit without, you know, having done their due diligence and thinking that there was actually a case here, which is kind of surprising because Mr. Ceglia is a convicted felon and has been charged with, among other things, criminal fraud in connection with a wood pellet company that he operated. Now, Facebook has come out saying that, you know, there's absolutely no merit to these. This guy's a convicted felon and we're going to fight this suit, you know, to the full extent of the law. But my question is, you know, if Mr. Ceglia is faking these documents, and these include emails between him and Zuckerberg, you know, if he is faking these, did he do a good enough job faking the emails to convince DLA Piper? And if he isn't faking these, you know, is Facebook actually in trouble, or specifically is Zuckerberg in trouble? Let's throw this out to the panel.
Well, first of all, I think we actually covered this when the initial suit was filed in 2010, and I think all of us were sort of like, kind of interesting, but this seems kind of light. And now it looks like the circumstances might have changed a little bit, but it's still really unclear, at least to me, what exactly Mr. Ceglia has that really shows that he is at least a part owner of the company. And what I would say to you guys is that what he's given us so far, that's been reported in the media at least, is the contract that he had between himself and Zuckerberg, which had a bunch of errors in it. There were some inconsistencies from the first and the second page. Then he also had a couple of checks, which later came out after the suit was filed, which he claims were checks that were delivered to Zuckerberg, canceled checks, which means that the payment has already been processed by the bank, but these are sort of like their payment slips, basically. And then he also has these emails which have come out. Now, I think out of the three of those, what's most damaging, just as in terms of an evidentiary standard, might be the emails. But you have sometimes have issues getting emails submitted into evidence in an actual trial.
Right. We actually we discussed, again, I think it was last summer, a case out of Massachusetts, where, you know, all of us live, regarding authentication of emails. Well, at the time, I think it was a authentication of a Facebook message, but it's the same basic idea. You know, what are they going to have to prove? To prove what are they going to have to show in court to prove that it was actually Mark Zuckerberg who sent these emails? You know, it's relatively easy to fake the headers on an email, so you know they're, you know, that'll almost certainly be a live issue at the trial, and you know, even assuming it gets that far and assuming that they actually, you know, let these be admitted, you know, with the way that they could be certified as authentic.
The other shaky thing about this is that I think he waited some 6 or 7 years before filing the suit. He claims that back in 2003 and early 2004 is when he was having these contract disputes, as he claims them to be, with Zuckerberg, but yet he waited all the way to 2010 to go ahead and claim those, and yet during that time, Facebook absolutely exploded. It became this huge, Web 2.0 phenomenon. And since then, it seems it's gotten so much publicity. How could you have not, heard of it getting so much attention in the media and elsewhere?
Right, and you can on our website there'll be a link to this article that contains the parts of the complaint and several of these emails. There's actually a reference at one point, several points in the email to the Winklevosses and Zuckerberg apparently being worried that if the Winklevi launch their site before he launches his, that there'll be some competition.
And if these emails are true, then I think Facebook is in serious trouble.
Well, not Facebook, because as the contract stands,
Zuckerberg,
the
sorry.
contract, yeah, the contract
The two are
specifies
synonymous,
that.
though, aren't they? Almost.
Not
Not really.
anymore, no, because
Zuckerberg
the company
has,
incorporated later.
Zuckerberg has, he doesn't have a more than a 50% share of Facebook anymore. I think he's got a controlling share, but I think it's somewhere in the realm of 23 to 25%. So, you know, instead of being worth however many billions he'll be worth, he may be worth half of that. But, you know, it would be substantial, but I don't think it would be ruinous.
Right, so that was one of the things that Zuckerberg did back in 2005 or so, after he had some angel investors come in, was that he had incorporated the company as a Delaware corporation, and at that point all the interests became divided amongst the various shareholders, which I think included those angel investors at the time. So the contract that Mr. Seglia claims is authentic specified that he would get 50% of the company, and then there were some penalties that had to do with the deliverables in the contract itself, where if Zuckerberg didn't meet it by a certain date, for every day that he was late, it was another 1% interest would then succeed to Seglia. Now, in the emails, what's interesting, I think, is that they sort of play out the story of Zuckerberg not meeting deadlines and being concerned about this additional interest actually going to Seglia in this project that they're working on, and then eventually sort of double-crossing him, or so to speak, and telling him that the website has basically failed. There's no interest in this project called the Facebook, so he's going to close it, stop working on it, and move on. So clearly, some pretty interesting factual disputes here. I think part of this is going to turn on whether or not these emails are actually authentic. Maybe either of you two could talk about how it would be possible from the technical standpoint to authenticate messages like that.
Well, I mean, as to, you know, the procedure, my guess is, you know, again, if this goes to trial or even at depositions, you know, the plaintiff's attorney, DLA Piper here for Mr. Seglia, would sit Mr. Seglia down, you know, put the document in front of him and say, "Do you recognize this document? Yes, what is it?" It's a copy of an email that Mark Zuckerberg sent me or an email that I sent Mark Zuckerberg. At trial, it would probably go along the same way, but, you know, the opposing party would raise objections as to the authenticity of this. And, you know, at which point, you know, you could look at, assuming that this information is preserved, the headers of the emails. And in the email, there's, and I don't know the technical details of this, so if Dominic knows, or Dave, if you know, you may be able to chime in. There's routing information at the top of, hidden, typically hidden at the top of an email. You can use different programs to tease out that information, but it essentially shows the route that the email went, where it originated from, what servers it was routed to through. So if you look at this and saw that it, was sent on the Harvard campus, routed through a Harvard server, and then to, some internet backbone somewhere near Cambridge, and then it finally went to New York, where this guy, Mr. Segley, lived at the time, and then to him, it would give some authenticity to the email. If you could verify it, if Harvard still had a backup of these, you could, if you could pull that email off of the Harvard server, that would be a way to verify it. Dominic, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, header information is going to reveal a lot, and these emails are pretty old though, so I'm not sure whether you're going to be able to get logs of the servers that the emails allegedly went through, because
Right.
that would be the ideal situation. You'd be like, all right, well, this header says server Bob handled this email in 2003, so then you go back in server Bob's logs and you say, oh yeah, Bob did actually send this email, and that's pretty much, I mean, unless he hacked into the Harvard servers and put in fake entry, which is basically not happening, then it's pretty legit.
Of course, we're assuming that these went to Zuckerberg's Harvard account, and I don't know if that was actually clear from the complaint. So we could be talking about a Gmail account or something, because Gmail was in beta back then.
Oh, not in 2003.
Not in 2003. Gmail
No, I
came
don't
into
think it was
beta
in.
in 2004, early 2004.
Yep.
They
Oh,
had a
snap.
limited rollout sometime around then, but I couldn't remember if it was as far back as 03.
Yeah, it was not.
Facebook launched a little bit before Gmail went into public beta.
Yeah, that very, very, very limited public beta at the beginning when Gmail invites were still selling for $100 on eBay.
How is this case going to proceed, do you think, Ben?
Slowly, very, very slowly. The first thing that we're going to see is Facebook do a response to the complaint. I didn't catch where this suit was filed. I believe it's in federal court, though.
Yes, it was filed in somewhere near Buffalo, I think a Buffalo District Court in New York.
Okay, well, so it'd be Western District of New York. They're going to have Facebook, oh God, if I remember my federal rules of civil procedure, 30 days to respond to the complaint unless they ask for extra time. They'll file basically a response which will go through and, admit that Mark Zuckerberg lives in such and such a place and that Facebook is a corporation located in such and such a place, but denying everything else. After that, there'll be depositions, there'll be discovery. There'll likely be fights about both of those things. It's going to drag its feet for a while. And then, if it doesn't settle out before motions for summary judgment, there'll be motions for summary judgment on both sides. And then eventually, assuming summary judgment isn't granted in favor of one plaintiff or another, it will go to a trial. But I'd be kind of surprised if it went that far.
It'll be interesting to see how this ends up getting resolved. Certainly, there's some factual contentions between the two parties, and I would assume that they clearly disagree on the facts. There was an ABC interview, I think it was, or maybe it was a CBS interview. One of the major network stations had done an interview with Zuckerberg a few years, or just a year or so ago, 2010, after this original suit was filed, when there wasn't any other evidence introduced. And Zuckerberg said that he thought that he would remember if there had been some contract between him and Seglia regarding the ownership of Facebook. But here's the interesting thing, though. I think that Zuckerberg isn't actually denying knowing Seglia, and he's purportedly got to know him over Craigslist. There was a Craigslist posting asking for some help on a coding project related to another website that Seglia was doing. And Zuckerberg says, yeah, that's what happened, and I did some work for him, and the payments that I received with these checks were related to that particular project. And on the checks themselves, there are some images online. If you Google around, you can look them up pretty easily. It's not very clear what the checks were being issued for. It doesn't say the Facebook project and the Street Facts project, which was the other project that was going on. So it's not clear if that those checks were just to pay for Zuckerberg's other work, or whether this had to do with some of the other ownership issues that Zeglia says that they do, and more in particular to the terms of this contract.
Yeah, I guess the one other interesting thing that I want to mention is that it seems like, while Dave, you mentioned that it was a 50% share and then an extra percentage for each day that Mark was late on that Street Facts side project, if you go through the emails, there's one where Mark suggests that it just be a 50-50 split because of the extra work that Mr. Zuckerberg did on the Street Facts project, which is then agreed to. But you know, there are going to be questions as to whether or not that was a valid modification of the contract. And if it was a modification of the contract, was it a modification for additional consideration? And you know, it's there are going to be a lot of interesting fights here.
I personally think there's going to be some tough issues to litigate for the plaintiff side of this, just because a lot of this occurred, you know, outside of the court. We're talking about a lot of potential hearsay evidence, although there's, you know, there's ways that you could probably get those emails in and the contract itself in as well. But it's going to turn down to, you know, a he said versus he said type of a case, it seems like. Unless there's some other evidence that comes out of the, you know, comes out of the blue that Zuckerberg can produce that points to him, you know, the arrangement being much clearer. We'll see, I guess.
Okay. Any last thoughts, Dominic?
I'll sit here.
Okay. Unless David has any thoughts, I think Dominic has our next story.
Yep.
The
FBI, with the permission of the Department of Justice, or with the court system rather, acquired a botnet and shut it down, which is pretty incredible if you think about it. Basically, they had to request a court filing saying that the FBI New Haven office wanted to grab control of the CoreFlood botnet, and the FBI was working with the nonprofit Internet Systems Consortium in order to do this, and basically they swapped out the software that the botnet computers were using for FBI software that would shut down the botnet itself. The FBI requested a temporary restraining order against anonymous parties, basically, that were behind the botnet in order to seize control of the botnet, because there had been a software update to the botnet that the government thought would make it more potent, potentially make it expansive, or cause damage to the machines that were part of the botnet. And the legal way this happened, basically, is the government got a temporary restraining order against various John Does, in other words, anonymous parties that were standing in place of the actual people running the botnet, because botnets generally tend to be pretty multiple layers. It's hard to get through to actually who's running it. You're not going to log on to botnet and say, "Welcome to Ben's botnet." So you don't really know who's responsible. So that's why they went through the anonymous John Does. And basically, the TRO, the Temporary Restraining Order, is what the government used to seize control of the botnet by effectively temporarily restraining legally the anonymous owners of the botnet. Botnets, I believe, are botnets technically illegal, or is it what you do with a botnet? Well, I guess a botnet in the sense of compromising machines would be illegal, right?
It's right, unless it's... Yeah, it would be...
But, yeah.
Yeah, if it's an unauthorized access to a computer system, it's illegal.
Right, but a botnet that is set up consensually, like, here, welcome to Dominic's botnet, join and help solve chess problems.
Right, yeah, SETI at home is not illegal, but this one was.
Right, and I guess the common definition of botnet is something that is self-propagating, doesn't really get people's authorization, and uses security compromises to... acquire control of machines. In any case, the government got permission for their TRO and went ahead and did the software magic that let them take control of the botnet and then shut it down. In the temporary restraining order, they make clear that they're not going to look at what's on the computers that have been compromised. They're not going to basically steal people's data or anything. They're just going to get on there, shut down the botnet, and then go away. And that's pretty much what they did. But this is the first sort of intervention of its kind, especially on this scale.
Well, three cheers for the government.
Well, I mean, they've gotten more and more competent with technology. It's not the 90s anymore.
But at the
Any
same
thoughts?
Time, are we... Well, yeah. I mean, the question that I have is, are we at all worried about the government going in and, you know, somehow asking for a court for permission to take over a computer? You know, not a botnet, or not to just kill the botnet, but asking the court for permission to remotely use some sort of known exploit to, say, access the computer of either a known criminal or, you know, just a person.
And that possibility always exists, but the court system and the need for permission before that hopefully will forestall any sort of abuses.
Well, I actually I have a much different take on this in terms of what could possibly go wrong. So let's say the government transmits some sort of code to the botnet, and it goes out to each of the individual zombie computers. And what happens if something happens to the zombie computer? It malfunctions, it stops working. Then you potentially have a scenario where the government is responsible for damaging an individual's computer.
That's certainly a possibility.
I mean, it's hard to know what's going to happen for sure when you issue the command to the computers, basically.
Right, but I think in this circumstance, as long as the government basically says we are not intending to cause any harm, and as best as we can tell, no harm is going to be caused, then I don't think they could be held liable for any sort of self-destruct command that happens if the botnet realizes it's compromised, or it's like, oh, I see you're going to compromise me, I'm going to blow up your computer. In a very Hollywood scenario there.
Well, that's a fair point, and it kind of goes without saying that the government here probably has best intentions in mind, and that they probably considered a lot of these things before doing it. And then part of that, this whole exchange between the court and the government is to sort of ensure that those issues are at least being acknowledged before they go about sending codes out to individual computers in the botnet.
Yeah, I mean, the scale of this botnet, one server that they actually, I believe they acquired, had 190 gigabytes worth of data and controlled 2 million machines in the botnet. Like, this is enormous.
So, on a side note, by the way, I went back into my Gmail account and I was looking at my spam. And on the day where they had supposedly issued the commands to stop the botnet from doing whatever the botnet does, I stopped getting spam for 3 days before I went without getting a single piece of spam for exactly 3 days, and then got a few pieces after that. But that's something that hasn't happened to me in a long time.
Wow.
Wow. And Gmail's gotten, I want to say, worse with spam than back in the day. Perhaps spammers have gotten better in terms of bypassing Gmail's filter.
Well, I usually get a ton of spam, but it all goes into my spam folder. It's usually doesn't come into my actual inbox. That I think the spam filters have been good at least of putting it into the spam folder. But yeah, I sure get a lot of it, let me tell you.
Now that we're already on this tangent, I heard somebody talking recently about the old trick of having one email address that you just use to sign up for, all those things, so that if you do get that all of your the idea is all of your spam goes to that one address. Do you guys still have those shill accounts? Because honestly, I just rely on Gmail spam filtering to take care of that for me.
That's interesting because I've always had one, and I have a special Gmail account that I use just for signing up for certain services, or going to the website that every now and then says, "Hey, we need you to give you we need you to give us an email address before we'll let you in and view whatever content that we have." And that's the one that I've always used. More recently, I've kind of stopped doing that because the filter's so good.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple alternatives. There's temporary email solutions that you just Google, like temporary email address, and you get an email address for an hour, and then it goes away. That's really convenient for sort of one-off sign-ups. Another option you can do is just have a secondary account for stuff like perhaps you're involved in a knitting society and you don't really want that spamming your main Gmail account, as an example. And finally, another cool trick with Gmail is if you put a plus after your email username, but before the at sign, you can actually put anything in there. So, for example, drabier plus technically legal at gmail.com would actually get sorted separately, and I could that way see all the emails that were technically legal relevant, so to speak. And you can use that to sign up for services like drabier plus Facebook, and that way I know if Facebook sold my email address to someone.
You can also tag all of your Facebook emails, well, all of the emails that come from Facebook that way, so that you'd know if so that you can tag them and or sort them just that way. That's interesting.
It's also interesting because then you could figure out who the third parties are that have your email address because of some licensing agreement that a website might have, or because, for instance, Chase Bank might use a third party like Epsilon or Allied Data to manage all the emails that you get related to their services. And all of a sudden, if you find that you're getting emails from some third party you've never heard of, but it's, my username plus Chase account, and it's coming from some non-Chase account, but apparently affiliated third party, then it'd be an interesting study to see how much your email address gets around just from signing up to one service.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on this story?
I'm all set.
I think I'm good too. And on that note, I think I'll take us away to our third story. And this is an interesting story. Evan Emery, who you might have heard of before, created a YouTube video that basically depicted him playing his guitar and singing a song that had sexually explicit lyrics to what appeared to be a group of first graders. And at various times during the video, the shots panned on him singing in front of these first graders, and also there were some school officials in the room that you might have been able to see from time to time. It was really interesting because that video went it went viral rather quickly, and I re actually remember someone passing it on to me at the time and asking me what I thought of it, and I didn't even make it all the way through the whole video because I actually found it to be quite explicit, and the fact that it involved children was, it's pretty offensive overall. But it turns out that what Evan Emery had done, and this is pretty clever, is that he went to the school and sang an innocent version of the song, which had lyrics that probably wouldn't have offended anybody. And I think the song was called The Lunch Lady. And he had recorded it then, brought it back to his home or wherever, and then edited it to include these now sexually explicit lyrics, but had used images from the day that he did the innocent lyrics in the classroom. And so he's basically mashed up a new song that looks like these kids were present when he was singing a sexually explicit song. And then he apparently on Valentine's Day, and this happened this year, performed it at a local comedy club, and this was in Michigan, by the way. And that's the point in time where people say that parents became aware that he had done this. But what wasn't clear, I think, to the parents, at least at first, was that the children weren't present for the sexually explicit version of the song. And the local district attorney got involved, and now, as of this week, Mr. Emery is in a plea deal with the DA. For basically a local Michigan statute which has him going to jail for 60 days. What that wasn't the worst that could have happened to him. He could have this was a felony offense which could have been punishable 20 years in jail, and he could have been fined up to $100,000 had he been convicted at trial. But looks like he took the plea deal, and so a couple interesting questions here. First of all, is this something that should have been protected under the First Amendment? I mean, the children weren't really there, so he made it. It was a mashup. This was all done by digital editing, but there's still something that's offensive about having it appear like the children were there while he was singing the song. And also, what did you guys think about the statute that was involved in this case?
Well, yeah, the original charge was manufacturing child pornography, which, if the statute actually was written to include what happened here, I would go so far as to say the statute was probably unconstitutional. What he ended up pleading down to was unlawful posting of an internet message with aggravating circumstances, and I have no idea what that actually entails, but either way, I find it kind of disturbing as a free speech advocate that he didn't do anything gross in front of kids. He later edited it so it looked like he did, but man, I'm really w worried about the implications of this kind of prosecution. No one was hurt in the making of this. No one was hurt in the editing of it so that it looked like something happened. It's just rubs me the wrong way that this guy's serving 60 days in jail for this.
It's not child pornography at any way, shape, or form. It's, I mean, which is the initial charge, but it got turned down to unlawful posting of an internet message with aggravating circumstances. I am not sure what exactly the definition of aggravating circumstances are, but I don't think it's an unlawful posting, is it?
There might have been some circumstances, and I don't know all of the details on this. I've just seen them discussed in several articles that involved school policies, and apparently, like, he had told the school officials at some point that he was going to be entering into the educational field, and he was doing this for completely different reasons than why he actually did it, which was apparently just to mash up the video. And then there's this odd sort of issue of filming the minors and then putting it up onto YouTube. The school has a policy that apparently the parents have to sort of sign off, opt out of their children being filmed if they don't want them to be filmed. And I think I saw some samples of the policy. It was pretty vaguely worded in some areas. It wasn't clear if they were just still pictures and audio, and that was the scope of the policy, or if it actually involved video too. And I don't think that the school was aware that he was filming, or it looked like there's some factual contentions on both sides.
Yeah. The statute says that a person shall not post a message through the use of any medium of communication, including the internet or computer or computer program, computer system or computer network or other electronic medium, without the victim's consent, if all of the following apply. The person knows or has reason to know that the posting message could cause two or more separate non-continuous acts of unconsented contact with the victim. B, the posting message is intended to cause conduct that would make the victim feel terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, or molested. C, conduct arising from the posting would cause a reasonable person to suffer emotional distress or feel terror, and to feel terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, and molested. Or D, conduct arising from the posting of the message caused the victim to suffer emotional distress and to feel terrorized, frightened, intimidated, threatened, harassed, or molested. So I really have trouble believing that any of those are really the case. And it has to be all of the following. The person has to know or have reason to, so in this case, the artist would have to know that it would cause separate non-continuous acts of unconsented contact with the victim, and that the victims would feel terrorized. Just, it doesn't seem to fit or be particularly constitutional.
Courts have afforded some states some broad power to protect minors from exploitation, and that seems to be at play at least a little bit here, although it's usually in regard to the visual depiction of minors involved in some sort of deviant or sexually explicit behavior. This didn't really seem to involve that, but it was highly suggestive of it because it showed a room full of kids and then it had these bad lyrics. But still, though, it's not quite, I mean, I question whether that arises to the level of actually depicting any acts. It just seems to be talking about it.
Yeah, and the law wasn't written to protect children. It was written to protect people from, you know, having, I mean, it sounds like compromising pictures of them posted online or you know, something that would cause emotional distress. And, you know, an actual, actual examples thereof, not manufactured examples thereof.
So apart from the statute that he actually plead to, do you think that if those first graders had actually been in the room while he did the song and it was filmed as the way that it appears, would that have been enough to get him under the other statute, the child pornography statute?
I haven't read their child pornography statute, but again, I don't think
I
so.
Doubt. I mean, I'm sure they would have charged him under the child pornography statute, but I don't think they would have met with success.
Yeah, and the charge was, the initial charge was manufacturing child pornography, which it sounds like was taking something that originally was not child pornography and making it child pornography, which in certain circumstances is also not unconstitutional, which in some circumstances punishment of that would be unconstitutional.
So apparently this just turns out to be a, I guess, a lesson of what not to do. What's the takeaway from this to people who are trying to create new viral videos on YouTube?
Don't mess with people's kids.
Yeah.
I mean, the parents were obviously extremely protective and they were really upset. It was interesting, though, that I don't think all of them really understood that the children weren't present, at least at first, at the time when he did the initial song with the innocent lyrics. And I think some school officials did send out letters to all the parents to explain him what exactly happened and how he did that. But, parents being parents, and depending on how old they are, I mean, who knows if they're up on, the latest web mashups and if they understand how easy it is to edit video to include things to make it look like something might have happened that didn't actually happen.
I mean, it's pretty tasteless, but I, as much as I condemn the fact that he made the video, I think that he had every right to make the video, and I don't think that he should be serving prison time for it. Although he pled, so I mean, that's his own fault at this point, because I think he could have fought this all the way to the Supreme Court and won.
I'm not really sure what to make of all of that because I honestly think, and his parents supported him. At least it was reported in the media that his parents supported him, and he made a mistake. It was more offensive than he intended it to be. So, yada yada yada. But I think that if there would have been a strong case that they might have defended it to that point. But and I would think also given all the various advocacy groups that are out there that. He maybe someone would have stepped forward to help him fund the legal defense, and if there was something that was colorable there under the law, that it would have been argued. That's
Yeah, I
what
mean,
part of me
but
thinks at least.
there's a line there between do you try to fight a possible 20-year sentence in prison or do you accept a 60-day sentence? Because, even if you have the ACLU backing you, if you lose 20 years, it's still 20 years and a
Well,
felony.
let me spin this a different way, though. So the 20-year penalties, by the way, were related to the original case that, or the original statute he was charged under, which related to the child pornography.
Right,
If
and
so, I mean, going forward, your option then as a defendant is this is going to be a part of the public record forever. You have to consider that 5, 10 years from now, when all of this is over and most of the public has forgotten about it, it's still possible that it will come up in a background check when he's applying for a job.
Yeah, the other thing worth noting, though, is that the 20-year manufacturing child pornography would have made him a sex offender, in addition to giving him a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison. So there were a lot of factors that would have, kind of urged him to plea out, even if he didn't think it was the right thing to do.
Right, all fair points.
Yeah, I mean, at the risk of, the dirty secret, and it's not a secret really, of the American legal system is that there's a lot of times where people plead out to things that they didn't do because it's easier than fighting it.
Yes, and it's as we all know, it's pretty expensive to fight it too, with legal fees, court costs, and
Yep.
so, any final thoughts, Dominic?
All set here.
All set.
All right, well, on that note, I think we can wrap this week up. Thanks again for listening to the Technically Legal Podcast. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabia.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
Please visit our website at technicallylegal.org, subscribe to our Twitter feed at @techlegal, and send us comments at podcast@technicallylegal.org. We'll see you next week.